Composers for the cinema. It's a cultural trip through everyone's most common musical experience. That's The Score with Edmund Stone, Saturday mornings at 10 on WICR, a different kind of public radio.
Hello, I'm Michael Toulouse of Classical Music Indie. As a host on 88.7 WICR, it's my pleasure to share a little information with you. The details, like Mozart's money troubles, Beethoven's ambition, Vivaldi's showmanship, that make the music come alive. But the greater pleasure by far is sharing the music itself. Share it with me here on a different kind of public radio.
Listen tomorrow morning from 6 to 10 on 88.7 WICR.
You're a busy person, and listening to WICR 88.7 is a great way to keep from stressing out. The music smooths out the rough edges and makes your day a little nicer. You have enough on your plate without having to remember to support your public radio station, too. When you become a sustaining member, you're setting up an open-ended membership. It means you can cross one more thing off your to-do list. And you know you're always current in your support of WICR 88.7. Give online at WICRonline.org.
Broadcasting from the University of Indianapolis, this is 88.7 The Diamond, WICR-FM and HD1 Indianapolis.
The opinions expressed on the following program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WICR management or ownership.
It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
And good afternoon. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, the curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And this is She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And today we are going to be talking about art and poetry and science and physics, about the intersection between the two. And your questions are welcome as always. That number to call is 317-788-3314. Mark, we have two guests again with us in studio this afternoon. Why don't you welcome them and introduce them?
Yeah, we have people we've had before. Thank you for coming back. We have Andy Gavarin, who's a physicist at IU.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Good to see you, Andy.
And we have Jessica Reed, who's also a physicist but a poet as well.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. Great to be here. So, Jessica, I wanted to start because I know that you just went to a workshop in the Southwest.
I did. I just got back from Squaw Valley, unfortunately named. We're still waiting for a new name for that. But it's up in the mountains near Lake Tahoe in California, and it was a great poetry retreat, kind of like a boot camp. It was fun.
A poetry boot camp.
Yeah, yes. Explain that.
That's a great image in itself.
It is. Well, you're just, it was nonstop. There was a poem due every day, and we had sessions and craft talks, and it was, you know, it was a lot of fun, very stimulating.
Yeah. And Andy, I know that poetry was not necessarily one of your favorite activities.
No, it wasn't, but, you know, I'm trying to learn. I'm always open to trying a new thing.
Right, and one of our dear friends and poet laureate, Joyce Brinkman, kind of really got you to even actually write a poem.
Yes,
and then
did.
Recently you actually were reading alongside her from the Bible while she was reading a poem, which I thought was all interesting. You want to talk a little bit about that journey from being where you were to being a poet?
Sure. Well, I'm certainly not going to claim to be a poet. I mean, I guess if writing putting words on paper once in your life makes you a poet, well, then
you're
then,
there.
Then my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Spillman, already accomplished that. But I think Joyce did a better job. She was more encouraging, and I had a good time writing something. I did not bring it, so I can't read it.
I have a copy of Andy's poem. I'm not going to pressure him.
Well, maybe you should read it then, Jessica.
Oh, no, no, no. You should read your own poem.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, we will give you an opportunity to do that. But I love this. I love this idea for both of you that how physics, I think, really lends itself to going with some sort of art form. And poetry is but one of them. But Jessica, how do you see that merger for you?
the distinction between poetry and physics is almost non-existent. I wouldn't claim that there aren't important differences. It's a completely different discipline in terms of how you approach. But poetry as a form of inquiry, as a way of knowing, physics is just... Physics, to me, is right there at the seam between mathematics and reality. It's just right there, you know, investigating at probably the most exciting place. So.
Well, and since Andy, since you are a physicist, and for those of us who are not, what do you do?
Well, all right. To go there probably would take us off in a tangent that probably we don't want to go on because we've only got an hour. But what I would like to say to follow up on what Jessica was saying is that one of the fundamental ideas of physics that we want to represent nature in the most efficient way possible. We want to use the fewest words, the fewest symbols, the fewest equations to capture the most complete picture of reality. And I think poetry really does strive for very much the same thing, to represent the world in an exquisitely efficient way.
So I know I'm biased about physics because I think that physics is the grandmother or the mother of all sciences.
Well, I'm not going to argue.
Yeah. So, but, and that's because I think it is trying to get at what you were saying, Andy and Jessica. It's trying to get at the essence of the simplicity of how it all works. Even though it's very complicated, it's trying to boil that down to something that it's tangible. So when people are listening, physics, I think, really is at the core that kind of inquiry, looking, questioning, and then trying to restate it. Do I have that kind of right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, physics, I look at it almost as, if you think of how do we make words in English? We make our entire English language out of 26 letters. And the number of combinations, the richness of possibility, how many things can you say with 26 letters is unimaginably huge. And it's the same with physics. We try to say, okay, there are very few fundamental rules, but within those rules, the number of things that can happen is vast. And how do we make that connection?
You know, when I was writing out the script here for us, and I kept writing poetry and psychics instead of physics.
Very different.
Yes.
But maybe not, because of that kind of thinking of many different ways, being open to things. I don't know. I felt it kind of curious, and I kept wanting to do that.
Yeah, well, I think where that's interesting, because I think one of the things that Andy, that you deal with a lot is unknowns.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what science is completely.
Right. And you're dealing with essentially things that are really difficult to know or to observe directly. Mm-hmm. You're always looking at something indirect.
Yeah,
and so much of physics takes place necessarily in the mind. There's this knower and the known, or this division, which doesn't really completely work, but this division between the investigator and the world. And so there's that. There's a high amount of abstraction involved in physics. So.
Wow, and so that explains, you know, it's a famous quote, but Einstein thinking about mind problems or problems in his head.
Yes.
I guess that is kind of the essence of what physicists do, is try to create for themselves, right, an image or something visual to explain what they're seeing.
Right, and so much of physics is unseen. So much of it is abstract or you know, not visible, whether we're talking about forces or fields or energy or just subatomic particles. And it is so difficult to visualize. That's, I think, why Niels Bohr said, when it comes to atoms, we can only talk as in poetry.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That really, speaking of poetry, did you have something that
I do.
That
I have
you're inspired by?
I have a poem or two I could read. I have one from my book, World Composed. And this kind of relates to what we were talking about. This is called Particle. Regarded by physicists as a material point, nearly hypothetical, real as an egg composed of matter. So little spatial extent, a place usually, a thing barely. I list the problem's knowns and unknowns, write velocity, position, the time elapsed. A particle's motion is described. Should I embroider an address? A point whose position changes in space. Why crumble soil between your fingers? Moving is a function of time, this pointed fingertip. Imagine a tiny dot as a ship in the water, in black space and sailing west to east, always west to east. One cannot chart the motion of a body through absolute space. Instead, we define the positions of bodies with respect to one another, a lover's body, silly and holy at once. You there and I here, and both hear a contradiction. I'm either very small, he said, or I'm nowhere at all. Atoms, thousands of times smaller than the smallest light waves our eyes can see, everything in an impossible radius.
Oh, that's beautiful. I've never heard a love story about an atom.
I know. I was thinking the same thing. I'm thinking you start us out kind of going down that science, nature, thinking about that path, and then all of a sudden you bring in the personal, the human, mm-hmm. human touch, literally.
Yeah, so. Wow. That's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Andy, you know, why particles? Why do we – I know that we have lots of things, but we always think mm-hmm. there's some particle inside a particle inside – you know, we keep going for a particle.
Yeah.
What if that were – why would we think there have to be particles?
Well, actually, now we're thinking there probably are strings.
Okay.
So, you know, it's just where our experiments have led us over time. And the idea of a particle, the word atom, actually, it comes from the ancient Greek, and it means an indivisible thing.
It couldn't have been broken into something else.
Right, right. Now, of course, that's not the way we use the word atom anymore, but that
right.
was the original idea of a particle, was of the the fundamental thing which we've been exploring ever since. And, you know, we found at first it was unclear whether there really were atoms, and, you know, then the evidence became overwhelming that there were, and then there became evidence that came to light that there were things inside of atoms. So we started looking at those. We just follow the path.
Wow. And so is it some – I know a big part of physics deals with, and it's also in your poetry, space or mm-hmm. the distance between things. And mm-hmm. so is it that when we think of an atom, it's that we think of a casing, which it doesn't really have, but it's because it's so close at the level that we were looking at it, that it felt as one thing. And then, so it's really maybe not something inside something. It was just stuff that was close together that made us feel like there was a shell or something? Or is it, or do we actually feel like it's a shell?
Well, you know, we use that terminology. You know, in chemistry, we still talk about shell, electron shells. It's not that simple. That's a good mental image to keep in mind because it captures some of the reality, but not all of it, which brings me to a very important idea, which is the idea of a model. Physics fundamentally is a model of nature. It's a model composed of language and of mathematics and of images and pictures that we can draw. But what's a model? A model is something that captures some but not all of the details of some other thing. And you use a model exactly because the main thing is too complex and you want to focus on some aspect of that.
Which brings me to what's so heartbreaking about physics and also so poignant and wonderful mm-hmm. about it is that there is this, it's not a wall exactly, but there's this gap between the reality, capital R, and what we can know. And it's phenomenal that we are able to describe and predict as well as we can, but it's always mm-hmm. a model.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's interesting because a model implies it's a human construct, that it's being constructed by humans to approximate it as close as they can figure it out. But what reality is unknown. So that creates this really challenging dual kind of thing that must go on in physicists' heads all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the old notion that the map is not the territory, that that the painting of a pipe is not a pipe.
Wow.
Physics is a field of learning. It isn't reality. Reality is reality.
Right, and we're trying to approximate. Yeah. So you use model as poets use models, or forms, right? Different forms. Is it for the same kind of reason that it allows you, if you have a form or a model, it allows you to then not have to worry about that for a little bit and use that to flow?
It becomes tricky because if you can, all poets write within a tradition, right? And there are models like the sonnet or the villanelle, and these are structures that we've inherited. But even when you write in free verse, there is a kind of formal imagination in poetry that's guiding you. And so even if you every time you decide to break a line or decide to give a stanza a certain shape, you're giving form to a thought or an impulse that you have, an
wow.
imaginative impulse.
Jessica, as a woman, what drew you into physics to study that, to become that, and then what made you leave that and cross into poetry?
Yeah, and that, Andy said about a question earlier that might take a whole hour in and of itself. this is another thing. It's a great question. So one part of the answer is that, I grew up with parents that didn't, prescribe limits to what I could and couldn't do. And so I was encouraged from a very early age to pursue science if that interested me, and it did. I had surgery one summer and was bedridden, so I had to read, and I read a lot of cosmology and books like that. So that was great. Physics is a forbidding discipline as it is, and it's not very female friendly,
and
not at all, right? And as a woman, that a lot of the world isn't very female mm-hmm. friendly, but it certainly was a challenge studying physics at the college level. But I think what happened is, again, there was many prongs to it, but I was writing. I was taking creative writing classes while I was studying physics, and I ultimately found that I had better tools to do the kinds of inquiry that I wanted to do in creative writing. I was more suited towards it, I suppose. I'm always going to be the outsider in love with physics, although I don't like that metaphor exactly, because I don't always like the woman being in love with something, but the physics is the high priesthood of science, so I'm a fangirl, but ultimately I think poetry is the form of expression that suits me best.
When you originally started studying it, what did you want to do with it?
I was at 16, I wanted to unite general relativity and quantum mechanics, because that was the problem there was.
Still is.
Right.
That and getting more women into the field is also a problem that still is. And
yeah.
We are working on that.
How are you working on that?
We're trying lots of different ways of encouraging young women to get into the field, to make it more human, to recognize the many, many different ways that being a physicist can allow one to express oneself regardless of gender. To help people out regardless of gender. For that matter, it is also currently we are trying to make the field open to people who are not binary. And that's an important piece of moving the field forward, bringing in all the different people, all the different ideas, and not making it a field that's depends on these externalities that really aren't important to your ability to inquire into nature.
So it makes some sense. We talk about this in so many other areas where the diversity, the need for diversity of thought, of people, really ups the game in terms of the thought processes of the types of models we create and those kinds of things. So you're talking about the same things here, that in the profession would also benefit from different points of view because you're creating models.
Yes.
And so if you've got a bunch of white guys all sitting around for years, we get a similar kind of model. Mm-hmm. Not totally, but we get some, but it can be something, a new perspective can be really interesting.
Absolutely.
So, Jessica, how does your, I mean, it's very unusual to have somebody who actually writes poetry about physics ideas, and as beautifully as you just did with that one, how do you go about creating a poem?
Oh my gosh, that question. So I'd rather read a poem.
That's like, what do you do?
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
but I'm always curious, where does it come from?
It's a highly intuitive process that is, like science, aided by lots of study of what exists already. So it's kind of, it's mysterious, but it's also, you know, it's helped if you've looked at the tradition and, can engage. I don't know. The process of composing a poem. Mine usually involve a lot of research. You know, if I'm interested in some particular idea in physics, I do research a lot, but then I have to strip the poem of its didacticism, you know, so that involves removing and removing and removing until, I don't know, what's left is something completely different from the textbook impulse to explain.
So do you always set out with a goal of, like, writing a set of certain poems about something and then going down that path till it's finished? Or do you just set aside time every day to work on poetry as to whatever you're researching? Or
So I have some obsessions. Really, the idea of the atom is an obsession of mine. And my first book, you know, is conceived as a dialogue with the ancient atomists, you know, because it made so much sense. Even though it turns out to be wrong, it made so much sense that there must be these indivisible particles and a void, so they had room to move. So I wrestle with that because now, you know, they're not particles and they have wave-like nature and they're maybe strings and there's all this, you know, perplexing, at best, you know, mystery at the heart of it all. And so I just find that if I sit down, you know, like I have a poem here where I wrote about being sick in the month of June and waking up in the middle of the night. I kept seeing these fireflies. But, of course, I sit down to write about that, and the idea of atoms comes out because it's an obsession. So.
Yeah, you want to read the poem for us, then?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. This is called Field of Vision. In the thick of summer, rising fireflies flash rain these acres as the rest of the world sleeps. I've seen it, feverish for 9 days and nights in June, on the strange schedule of sickness, when I would lumber to the kitchen for mineral water, and the carbonation in my glass simulated in miniature the scores of lifting lights in sight. My neck aching and my head dull, the room opened into the wide, silent scene. Charles Wright said of affliction, the world becomes more abundant in severest light. You see, I have been trying to find the right level of attachment to this world, to consider the decomposition of bodies truly, trace dog atom to dirt atom, dust atom to breath atom, so that I might achieve a divine indifference, witness what I can while I can, endure the vomiting, the fever, the mania, all for the effervescence and luminescence, for the lightheadedness that follows. Wright was thinking of Simone Weil, who once said, "We do not become detached, we change our attachment. We must attach ourselves to the all. I'm ready to make that happen. In the spaces where there is no world, we infer void. But where is such a place? I press my fingertips and thumbs together, and even in the limit they never touch, only fields repelling. Suppose everything is atoms in motion, tiny billiards colliding. I believe this even though the truth about billiards is that they never touch, that all contact is an illusion. Our minds evolved for fitness, not truth. So my ad hoc reality is constructed from silhouettes of mental objects. That seam between my fingers, inhabited structures, ascending and descending. Attachment, this world, simple cravings. Cool water, dark chocolate, red meat. Yet all I know of, say, infection, after weeks in bed, is only how sounds have become fainter. If a mind could hold the truth of matter's temporality, nothing would matter. They also said that it was better to say, I am suffering, than this landscape is ugly. Still, it is in the duration of darkness between flashes that the firefly communicates with her mate. Envelope of air and water, another sustaining absence. A field is a field in the spaces where we infer void, but where I press my fingertips, in the limit they touch.
Andy, as the physicist, what do you think of that poem?
I think it's wonderful. I think there's a lot of physics in there, and it's very well represented.
Thank you.
And you know, it leads me to ask a question. I've been wondering, Jessica, when you write a poem like that, or like the first one that you read, are you thinking about your audience in terms of them gaining a deeper understanding of the ideas or an appreciation of the beauty of those ideas? What about physics do you hope someone takes away from a poem like that?
Yeah, so audience is the perennial problem for me, always has been. So I have to assume that my readers have some familiarity, but like in that poem, for instance, maybe I'm hoping to expose some people to the idea that all contact is mm-hmm. about fields repelling, you know.
Right.
So, you know, there's a core idea there that, you know, but I think most people are familiar with the billiard ball kind of model, you know, that we've discussed is not quite right.
Right. Yeah. But I doubt that they're familiar with the idea that billiard balls don't really touch, where that word really, of course, is incredibly loaded
right.
with.
Right. Yeah, so that's the hope, is to kind of impart mm-hmm. some of that awe and wonder, because so many people just don't quite realize how amazing physics is.
Okay, very good.
Well, and if you're listening and you have questions, this is your time to give us a call, 317-788-3314. We are speaking with and listening to poetry with Jessica Reed, and also Andy Gavran is here with us as well. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with more of She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Michael Toulouse of Classical Music Indy. As a host on 88.7 WICR, it's my pleasure to share a little information with you. The details, like Mozart's money troubles, Beethoven's ambition, Vivaldi's showmanship, that make the music come alive. But the greater pleasure by far is sharing the music itself. Share it with me here on a different kind of public radio.
Listen tomorrow morning from 6 to 10 on 88.7 WICR.
Monday evenings here on WICR, you can tune into the Owl Music Group radio show hosted by local jazz musician Kenny Phelps. Kenny presents interviews with local and national artists as they travel through the Indianapolis area. He features their music and spotlights agencies that produce change in and around our communities. That's the Owl Music Group radio show on Mondays at 9 p.m. on WICR The Diamond.
Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee. Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
When you listen to Folk Alley, you experience a tradition that's been handed down for hundreds of years. I'm Elena C., and Folk Alley is a link in the chain that includes the ancient child ballads and the latest releases from your favorite singer-songwriters. Bluegrass, Celtic, Americana blues, and much more. It's all part of the Folk Alley mix. So I hope you'll join me each week on Folk Alley.
Join us for Folk Alley, Sundays at 9 p.m.
That's cool.
And welcome back. I am Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and you're listening to...
She Says Art.
And He Says Science. And we're talking with Andy and Jessica about the intersection of physics and poetry and kind of touch and life as well. If you have a question, please call us at 317-788-3314. I think, Jessica, in that last poem, there is so much incredible, not only physics happening, but other things. One of the things that it touched me strongly was this idea of that humans crave touch.
Yes.
And the connection. And then in physics, you come to find that things can't touch. And so it's really hard for me.
Right, isn't it? It's the idea that nothing's ever quite touching the way we imagine it is.
And I think that's actually a fair statement. Nothing is touching the way we imagine.
Right.
It doesn't mean things aren't touching. It just means that we've come to understand what touching is at a microscopic level that's a little different from what people might assume just looking at things at the human scale.
Yeah, I know, Andy, it's, you know, as a child and then when I was in college trying to learn physics, one of the most difficult things was that idea of space between things and how tight things are and how they're not. In other words, you know, how a piece of metal can be a liquid, but then it's in various states in between. And we always think of it as having no space and not moving, but and yet there's stuff moving in it. Which to us, something that looks like it's not moving and then it's moving, it's hard. It's a really hard concept to understand.
Right. I mean, the idea that the air around you is made up of particles that are actually very far apart compared to their size and are moving much faster than you would ever feel the wind move. And that the wind is just a slight addition of an average motion to that collection of things that are all moving constantly in different directions and bouncing off of each other that we can't see directly with our eyes.
Andy's a fantastic natural philosopher.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, that there might be a really good tie-in between philosophy and physics.
Oh, absolutely.
Because cosmologies and those ideas really are a part of who humans have been forever. Mm-hmm. We've tried to create our own understandings of the world through that. Wow.
And I'd like to stress something here
just
for a sec, Mark, which is that when physicists say that at the microscopic level, things appear different, that things don't, for instance, this idea that things don't exactly touch, it doesn't mean that our perceptions at the human scale are wrong. Right. When I reach out and touch someone or I put my hand on the table in front of me, I'm touching it as far as I'm concerned. I can feel it. There's a sensation in my hand and to say that I'm touching it makes complete sense and isn't wrong. It just means that there's an additional layer of truth underneath there that looks different.
Yeah, and I think that's great, because I think that's where in science we get sideways a little bit with the public, in that the public sometimes thinks it's absolute one way or the other, and we don't do a good job of saying, from your perspective, you're 100% okay.
Yeah.
From a different perspective, it's different.
Yeah, quantum weirdness doesn't scale up the way some people would like to claim that it does.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And this whole idea of disproving things, you know, that Einstein disproves Newton, we don't speak of it that way. We still teach Newtonian mechanics, and we do so for good reason, because it's a great description of the world. It's not a great description at all scales, and we need other theories to describe what happens at other scales, but it is a great system for many scales of reasoning.
So this gets to the core of the idea of exploring creativity, because one of the things people want and they push towards, even I was beginning to do that with you, Jessica, but try what, like, what's the formula to, you know, to create a poem, or what's the formula to come up with a model, Andy?
Right, yeah.
If I do these things, will I just get there? Will this come? And yet, it's a lot more messy than that, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so it's a matter of, I don't think we can, I love it when somebody comes out, we're going to teach a course on creativity or innovation. It's kind of like, really? Because I don't know how you do that. I think exposing people to lots of things. So what, from your experience, Jessica, what kinds of things, living life, does that, an exposure to the ideas of physics, has that led you somewhere?
Living life and reading a lot and having meaningful conversations with people like this conversation right here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think in that last poem, too, I mean, you can look at it from a completely different way, maybe from the non-scientific kind of way, just as someone who appreciates beauty and words and everyday living. We all know what fireflies are, so we can all completely relate to that. We've all been sick. Yeah. We've all vomited. Mm-hmm. We've all had fevers. We've all known what that's like to stumble in looking for a glass of water. And as you take us through that poem, we remember that in our head, or we think of other people that have gone through that. So you're relating to us in many different ways, the least of which could be the science aspect of it, the physics aspect of it, which could have been your total intent from the get-go. But that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think most of the day you're not thinking about these very esoteric philosophical ideas. You know, most of the time you're just trying to get through having this fever and coping. And a lot of that poem that I just read was about attachment to the world and, you know, how attached can we feel. And so sometimes I'm just trying to reconcile these beautiful but very abstract ideas with the human experience.
Well, and I think that's another reason, as you said, to read and research, and maybe someone who's never thought about physics or anything, but they have these feelings and they wonder about these things. And they think there's nothing out there to help them explain it, but there is. I mean, that's another thing we talk about a lot here on the show, is different aspects of science. And when you mentioned, Andy, about getting more girls involved or more women involved and just more people in general involved, there are many different things you can do with the study of physics.
Absolutely. I mean, physics is a way of understanding the world around. Well, I'll give an example that I heard on the radio. Since we're here in the radio station, I'll take a radio example. A number of years ago, and unfortunately I'm going to forget the gentleman's name, but they interviewed a basketball player, college basketball player, who was a physicist, who had applied the ideas that he was learning in his physics class to improving his jump shot. He realized that if he put more arc on the ball, then the cross-section that the net, that the rim presents to the ball is greater as it comes down straight than if it's trying to go in at an acute angle. I personally had this experience. This is going to sound silly, but I'll tell you. I travel a lot, and I very frequently travel with a laptop and a case, and it's heavy. And when you're walking up the aisle of the plane, you've got to carry it in front of you so you're not banging into people. But then I want to hang it over my left shoulder. So I've got it, and I'm holding the shoulder strap as well as the handle in my hand. And I know that if I just drop the bag so that I'm only holding the shoulder strap, it's going to jerk my shoulder. And I already have a bad rotator cuff there. So I don't want to do that. What I figured out as a professional physicist in my 40s was that if I let go of the bag and moved my hand up rapidly, I could get the strap taut before the bag had a chance to accelerate and gain momentum. And it's easier on my shoulder.
Wow. There you go.
Yeah, and you know, that, Jill, that does happen all the time where science comes into play. You know, through Da Vinci Project, we work a lot with different artists and scientists. Hundreds, really, that we've met and we've talked to. And one universal thing is really not the idea of liking very much the STEM movement. And the reason I bring it up is because I think those ideas must come from somebody who isn't in science or art. They must come from a business person or from a politician, because it sounds like what you both are saying is the immersion in liberal arts that include a healthy dose of understanding of science, a healthy dose of other things, might move us further towards creating women scientists and others than with this idea of STEM.
Yeah, I tire of the whole STEM, and then people say, well, what we need is STEAM. Well, yeah, all along we needed it all.
I agree. I've never been one that felt like there was any need for the entire population to go into STEM fields. That's
right.
Never been my goal. I think anybody that wants to should be able to and should be encouraged to. And I think that's the underlying part of that movement, if you will, that is valuable.
Right.
But pushing people into it that don't have an interest is pointless.
No, and they're just going to resent it.
Yes, they're going to resent it, and there's no reason for it. They're not going to benefit by being pushed into it, and they're not going to benefit the field if they're there because they were felt obligated or pressured.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this goes back to the idea of being creative and solving problems, but I think maybe we're looking at the wrong problem. The problem that we want to look at is that we need more women and diversity in science. But we look at it as it's the way the subjects that we teach is the problem. Instead of backing up for a minute and saying, what are the barriers? You know, we have really good science out there being taught. Mm-hmm. We have really good science teachers. We have really good math. What are the barriers that are keeping people? It can't be just that we teach it so badly or something. And I think that we get all twisted.
Yeah, and also sexism, it is entrenched in the sciences, but it's everywhere. I mean, if you look at the poetry world, it's white men getting published. They'll release these pie charts, you know, and who's winning the awards and who's, you know, it's there. Mm-hmm. It's there. So if we can attack sexism broadly, culturally,
right,
you know, then we don't need to necessarily target the sciences. It should just follow. But maybe that's a naive perspective, but it's my hope.
And that kind of circles back around to what Da Vinci Pursuit and what this show is all about, too, is bringing together artists and scientists. Different people might think that you're in totally different fields talking about different things, but you're really talking about the same thing. We need to bring more people together to talk, to share their ideas. Our last show, we talked about design and mm-hmm. and how important it is to have so many different viewpoints and expertise and experts together when you are trying to design something, whether it's from a layout of a city, the layout of an environmental plan, or a special event. You can't just rely on one or two people to railroad the whole thing, or you end up with what we have right now, which is mm-hmm. silos. Once again, everybody's in their own space.
Yeah, and there is a real need, obviously, for going deep with some expertise in certain areas and exploring that. But I think that comes a little bit later. One of the things that I find as an educator, both a science and art educator, is the idea of that we pushed elementary kids to learn stuff for a career, which is crazy to me. When we should just be allowing them to explore art and science freely and without having, you know, to be sure they're going to be ready for what, because I think we make them more ready when they're exploring. And so that's been my downside of really the STEM movement, is pushing these ideas that you have to learn these concepts, which perhaps would be out of date by the time they could use them anyway.
Possibly. I think in general, pushing within the educational system creates all kinds of problems. Teaching is a very difficult thing to do. I have enough trouble teaching at the university level. Teaching in the K-12 system can only be more challenging. And my kudos to anyone that's taken on that challenge in society today. But I will say, I remember as a kid being pushed to write poetry and to be pushed to write stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't matter whether I was interested or not. It was an obligation. I had to be a poet because everybody in the room had to be a poet that day. And it did not give me a good feeling for it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it could have been done differently, or maybe I was just having a bad day. But
Or maybe it just took you into running into Joyce Brinkman again.
Maybe. Well, Joyce has been a great teacher.
Speaking
of
which,
incredible poet too.
Okay, yeah.
And we've, and Joyce has been on the show multiple times as well too. So we're not forcing you, Andy. If you don't want to read it, you don't have to. But we would be really interested to hear.
Okay. Well, I will do it.
And give us a little more background too for maybe people that.
Sure. So I've been meeting with this group of scientists and artists that Mark has organized for many years, and both of you have been great contributors to that, as well as Joyce Brinkman. And I was talking with Joyce one day, both during and after one of those events, and she started pressing me about poetry. You know, what did I like? What was I interested in? And I kind of said, oh, Joyce, you know, I hate to say it, but of the many, many art forms there are, poetry is one of the ones that I find the most difficult. I don't feel like I get it. And she said, well, you have to write one then.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Reliving your elementary days.
I'm reliving my elementary school days, and I'm reliving that pain. And, oh, boy, and, you know, now I'm really on the hook. And now here I am on the radio, and Jessica, who is a great poet and understands a great deal of physics and has been working at this for years, has just read two wonderful poems, and now here I am on the hook. But I'll do it.
Everybody has a first poem.
Yeah, okay. So this is mine, or at least my first as an adult. So this is titled 13 Ways of Looking at Hydrogen, and it's written with apologies to Wallace Stevens.
Who was?
He was a modernist poet. Can I jump in?
Sure, go ahead.
He has a very famous poem called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, Wallace Stevens. So it's a great model that he was working with.
Right. And Joyce suggested that as a model for me. I think understanding that to be creative, sometimes you have to put a bit of a box around things. If you just say to somebody, oh, go be creative, it doesn't matter what you create, it's almost impossible. But if you narrow the field a little bit for them, then it gets a little easier. Mm-hmm. So 13 ways. One, NLMS, or waves of differential equations from Legendre and Associates. So easy to compress, but all details are still inside. We teach our young to hunt there. Two, the most common thing in the universe. Three, one of these and one of those, simplicity itself. Underneath, fine, hyperfine, lamb and beyond, a knot years in the unraveling. Four, Lyman, Balmer, Passion, series after series, without end, but approaching continuum. Five, for chemists, found in England, named in France for making water, you do not want to ride under a big bag of it. Six, like Houdini, an escape artist, it slips through rings and skins, Earth's gravity cannot hold it. Seven, dazzled, shading luminous eyes beneath the hand that earlier held a flute, champagne-kissed orange for a lazy morning, it fuels all this and night's barest glimmers. Eight, ubiquitous and rare, it calls at 21 centimeters. Is anyone out there? Nine, dancing to the radio tune, flipping, tiny notes from within reveal molecular structures and bulging disks. 10, so light it escapes its own grasp and is solid only in a pinch between diamonds or perhaps on Jupiter. Maybe metal? Still struggling. 11, in light gas guns, it does the work of expansion. No need to explode, but damn those bullets move. 12, isotopes 2 and 3 fuse more easily, hopefully in a Russian ring, not another bikini. 13, a fuel for future cars, the name for an economy, reality, or political football. We hand this one off to the engineers.
I love it.
It's a great poem.
It is.
It is. The first time adult poem by Andy Gavron.
There you go.
It's got humor. It's got science. It's got humanity. And you started off kind of formal with it, with mm-hmm. the kind of the description of, if I knew what the hell you were talking about, I would understand it. And then you came to me, to the human, and started relating things to me. Oh, that's what hydrogen, that's what it is. Oh, I never thought of that. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And now I'm intrigued. Now I want to hear the rest. And now you're adding some humor in there too, mm-hmm. which is great. So then your personality comes out as well too. It's a terrific program.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Thank you for sharing that with us and the audience.
Well done.
Sure.
And then I'm sure Joyce is listening, and she's probably going to call you after this and say, okay, Andy, here's poem number two. Here's the outline.
Okay. Well, that's the beauty of the form. Joyce was very smart to suggest that form because the constraints do encourage one to think about whatever the object of the ode or the meditation is, you know, to think about them in completely different ways, and these little kind of bite-sized capsules. That it's really great.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's with poem. When you're a child, you're brought up with, like, nursery rhymes, so things have to rhyme. So you automatically think, oh, my gosh, if I write a poem, it's got to rhyme, and it's got to have a beginning and a middle and an end, and it can be kind of overwhelming if you're not thought and taught to think that way. But as we've mentioned, there are many different styles and many different types of poetry. It's just another way of using your brain and thinking about things in a different way, painting different pictures. All right, well, we are talking with Jessica Reed and Andy Gavran. They are both physicists and both poets as of a minute and a half ago.
All right.
We're going to take a short break, and then we will be back with more of She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Congratulations to WICR's Artist of the Month for July, Lisa Maxwell. We talked to this jazz composer and arranger about her debut album, Shiny, her previous work throughout television and with Guns N' Roses, and the late and great trumpeter, Lou Soloff. To listen to our full interview with Lisa, go to WICRonline.org. Congratulations to WICR's Artist of the Month for July, Lisa Maxwell.
Have You Heard airs every Wednesday at 9 p.m. right here on WICR 88.7. Have You Heard is a jazz radio show hosted by Matthew Altizer and Richard Dole, where we interview some of our favorite musicians and play some of our favorite music. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 p.m. or stream us live at WICRonline.org and discover some new music you didn't know you loved.
The Score is a weekly celebration of the music that makes good movies great. Host Edmund Stone covers all the bases with such topics as playing politics, summer blockbusters, The Orchestrator, Stranded, and features on individual composers for the cinema. It's a cultural trip through everyone's most common musical experience. That's The Score with Edmund Stone, Saturday mornings at 10 on WICR, a different kind of public radio.
This is Rockin' Dave, inviting you to join me every Sunday at midnight for Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, an hour of the best rockabilly, jump blues, and western swing. That's Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, every Sunday at midnight on WICR The Diamond. Get your roots on!
Welcome back.
Monday evenings here on WICR. You can tune in.
Welcome back. We are back again here with She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And a little extra commercial time for you there, too. And we're talking about the intersection of physics and poetry this afternoon.
We are. And we ended with a wonderful poem, Janelle, that Andy read for the first time on air, which is really impressive. But, you know, it led me to think, when you were talking earlier about models, both in physics and in poetry, that there must be something really important to come back to with that.
I wanted to talk about physics as opposed to the other disciplines, and Andy might be familiar with this joke. It's a joke they used to tell at Purdue about the there's someone who goes to the horse track. I'm going to bungle this, but you know, he's trying to devise the way to get, you know, the most money for it. And the engineer does all right, but the physicist fails miserably. And he says, what? I don't understand. I used a perfectly spherical horse on a frictionless track with no air resistance. And such. So the idea is that physicists work in this very idealized, distilled environment that doesn't actually exist, but it's this very romantic kind of impossible, you know, they neglect aspects of reality.
Yeah, I think that's a common form of joke. And there's actually a whole variety of, you know, assume a spherical cow, horse, car, you know, whatever. And what that is a perfectly reasonable satire of the way we teach the introductory physics course, where we start with one-dimensional motion in a frictionless environment of a particle, which is an object with no spatial extent. But then, of course, we do add on the rest of reality. But the idea of starting from an abstraction in order to simplify things and then adding the complexity back in layers is a very fundamental part of the way we teach and the way we learn physics. And actually, it's reasonably well-founded. If the idea was, okay, we're going to start out by solving a problem for a funny-shaped object traveling in three dimensions with air resistance and friction, and it's got a tumbling motion, and there's also energy being added to it by rocket engines or something like that, then you have the problem that all the students have to really understand partial differential equations first. And that's an unreasonable assumption. So we don't go there. We start with something simpler, and it does lead to that satire.
Yeah, and it kind of leads me down the path when I was a kid and remembering a teacher telling me all the time, do your own work. Because if I did my own work all the time, I wouldn't be very creative. And so one of the things I think about was that models help us because they give us a framework in which to be creative. And they put those parameters you're saying, Andy, around it. And it's not plagiarism. You didn't actually plagiarize that person's poem, but you used a framework that poet had
that's
used.
Right. Yes.
And some people would say, oh, that's not original. But really it is, because I don't think that too many things are original, that we aren't seeing and looking and doing that. What do you think, Jessica?
I think I have a poem.
All right.
Oh, good.
This is a shorter one, but it kind of circles around some
Perfect.
Of these ideas. It's called Hypothetical Flawless. Peeking at a core self, the universal bones in your head, the form of a body, what can never fully be realized. Idealized single crystal of the absolutely pure element. Once the purview of the religious, perfection now belongs to physics. Hypothetical flawless, chased into the unrealizable realm. Your skin is growing transparent, starting its slow slide off the meat of your face. Eye sockets, jaw, dark cavity in place of a nose, your core peaking. Early March magnolia buds of green fur, white petals peek through the folds, a full month before they are due to bloom. Buds sublimely indifferent. Snow comes and goes, white petals turn yellow, dew as temperature dictates this year. One triumphant white, hypothetical, flower for every 15 brown, shriveled, unrealized.
Wow.
Very pretty.
It's fascinating.
So I think this idea of perfection is one that I keep circling back to, this perfect model universe that we're always chasing after. Yeah,
and they even down to the level that for you to call yourself a physicist or a poet, you have to be perfect. And I think that's a problem. I think when one of the things I remember about many children that I've worked with is the idea that oftentimes they believe they're something before the world can tell them they're not. In other words, I'm an archaeologist, I'm a something. And I think we lose the essence of that, Jill, sometimes even in art, if we don't think of ourselves as an artist or we don't think of ourselves as a painter. And there's levels of accomplishment and perfection, but the point is that once you start, you are.
Yeah, I agree. And the idea of perfection, it goes back to the idea of making mistakes. And one of the big issues that we struggle with in teaching is the idea that people have to make mistakes. It's fine to make mistakes. It is, in fact, essential to make lots and lots of mistakes. I often tell my students, I used to ski, and if I got to the lodge at the end of the day and I wasn't wet and kind of dinged up, mm-hmm. that meant that I wasn't pushing myself. I wasn't getting any better because I wasn't falling. It's very much the same way when you're learning physics or any other science or math or any other area. If you don't mess up, then you're not pushing yourself. You're not trying new things.
Wow.
And I wish I'd known that when I was an undergraduate studying physics. The way that I am as a student changed drastically over the years as I taught. And mm-hmm. yeah.
Yes. Well, and Andy, I'm guessing you probably messed up a couple times on that poem, but you forged ahead and it turned out well.
Yeah, absolutely. There was lots of rewriting involved there. And whether it's better or worse than it was in some previous step, I don't know. I know I like it better this way. That's all I can say.
You took the chance.
Yeah.
Jessica, where can we find your work? Mm-hmm. People enjoyed it. Where can they get a copy of your book?
Let's see. The World Composed is a chapbook. It's available from Finishing Line Press, but it's also it's on their website, but it's also on Amazon. You can find it on Amazon.
Okay.
I have a full-length book that is, fingers crossed, going to be coming out soon. It was just a finalist in a competition, so I'm pushing it. So
right.
We'll look forward to that.
I'm looking forward to it.
Jessica and Andy, thank you both so much for being here today. We really, really appreciated your time.
Thanks.
And
so much.
You'll find pictures
of
their projects, and hopefully we'll put a link up there, Jessica, as well. And other guests on our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
Until then, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And Mark, we're
reminding
you
to
stay curious.
Hi, I'm Joe Bainline. If you like misheard lyrics and awesome t-shirts, you should head over to abftp.com. If you like songs from the 80s and early 90s, you should listen to A Blast from the Past, Saturday evenings at 10 on 88.7 WICR. A Blast from the Past is a weekly public radio look back to a time when songs were sappy, movies were cheesy, and mixtapes were it. A Blast from the Past, Saturday night at 10 on 88.7 WICR.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.
Broadcasting from